Hi everyone, Alistair Willis here, Music Director of your South Bend Symphony. Welcome to our season's fifth and final Aha with Alistair podcast. We're going to delve into the two hugely contrasting pieces on our upcoming Jack M. Champagne Masterworks by two composers who were somewhat linked to each other. Richard Strauss' beautiful tone poem called Death and Transfiguration, and Karl Orff's instantly recognizable, iconic Carmina Burana. What links them? Both pieces are program music, music which describes a scene, text, or story. Strauss offers a musical vision of dying and the afterlife, while Karl Orff takes us on the bawdiest party known to classical music. Both composers were German. Both survived World War I and World War II. Neither Strauss nor Orff left Germany during World War II, and both have been subject to much speculation as to their relationships with the National Socialist Party. Orff never joined the National Socialist Party. He viewed himself as apolitical, while simultaneously accepting a salary from the Reich's Chamber of Culture. Strauss was exonerated in his denazification trial as innocent of any ties to the Nazi state. And while these similarities make for a fascinating study, in this podcast, I'd like to focus on the music. Let's start with Strauss. Tod und Verklärung, Death and Transfiguration, is a tone poem. A tone poem, or symphonic poem, is a single-movement orchestral work that describes a poem, a story, or landscape. The composer Franz Liszt was the first to apply the name to 13 of his compositions, and these inspired symphonic poems from many composers, including Smetana, Dvorak, Rachmaninoff, Sibelius, Tchaikovsky, Debussy, and Richard Strauss. Death and Transfiguration is the third of nine tone poems he composed. Strauss actually composed the music first and after asked his friend Alexander Ritter to describe it in a poem. So no surprise that Ritter's poem exactly follows the music. It describes a man on his deathbed looking back at his life, then the moment of death, and the glorious redemption and transfiguration it brings. The first thing we hear is the man's irregular heartbeat played softly by violins and violas. The timpani then continues the heartbeat, followed by two sighs in the strings. The man is suddenly shaken awake, struggling with the urge of life and the power of death. He has his first glimpse of the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
Let's call that the Transfiguration theme. He then falls asleep again, and in his dreams he looks back on his life, starting with the innocence of his childhood. He thinks back to his student days. As he matures, so does the struggle with life. He focuses on his ultimate desire for redemption and transfiguration, which he hears again. We hear the transfiguration now three times. Three times he reaches and ultimately slips back into sleep with the music from the beginning. One last time he is shaken awake. The music seems to disintegrate into the moment of death, which is marked with the stroke of a type of gong called a tam-tam. The final 7 minutes are filled with the most glorious, uplifting, transcendent music ever composed. The Transfiguration theme, of course, returns, at first very softly, and gradually builds into the most magnificent, luminous, full orchestra statements describing perfectly the end of the poem, which reads, quote, "He hears, resounding from heaven, that which he sought here longingly. World redemption, world transfiguration." When I first heard this piece, I was drawn to it immediately. The struggle with health, wondering what happens when we die, reminiscing on happy memories, imagining heaven, these all still resonate with me. It was to me such a complete, mature, complex, brilliantly composed, deep musical statement. What I still find astonishing is that Strauss composed it when he was only 25 years old. Fast forward 60 years to the end of Strauss' own life. One of his final compositions is called Four Last Songs. And in the song Im Abendrot, which means at sunset, he quotes the Transfiguration theme right after the soprano's final line, Ist dies etwa der Tod? Is this perhaps death? Then, at the end of his life in 1949, he said to his daughter-in-law as he lay on his own deathbed, "Dying is just as I composed it, in death and transfiguration." Our second half belongs to one of the most iconic pieces ever composed, a piece that's guaranteed to fill a concert hall. The famous opening of Carmina Burana by Karl Orff. Composed in 1937, it was Orff's first attempt at total theatre, a combination of music, word, movement, and visual spectacle. He wanted to engage listeners who had lost their way with the complexities of 20th century music, and boy, did he succeed. The premiere was wildly successful, and it remains so today. Carmina Burana's Total Theatre was originally conceived for mimes, dancers, soprano, high tenor, baritone, five other vocal soloists, chorus, boys choir, and a large orchestra with emphasis on percussion. Phew! I've never seen a fully staged production that included all that, and I'd love to. The closest I've come was when I was invited to conduct several performances with the magnificent Pacific Northwest Ballet in Kent Stoll's marvelous production. Carmina Burana is most commonly performed in the Concert Hall, which is where you can experience it on April 18 with the South Bend Symphony Orchestra. Karl Orff's inspiration came from a collection of medieval poems, which he came across, by chance, in a second-hand bookstore in Würzburg, Germany, in 1934. He was drawn to their content of lust, eroticism, drinking, gambling, descriptions of spring, of church leaders, as well as sacred medieval mystery plays. The first poem is about Fortuna, the Roman goddess of fate, who spins her wheel as she likes to create suffering or joy for her subjects. She features in Orff's opening movement, Fortuna Imperatrix Mundi, Fortune, Empress of the World. And some 60 minutes later, our circle is complete as the same music ends the piece. Orff divides the poems into three sections, Spring, In the Tavern, and Love. The poems range from mysticism to earthly simplicity, from bawdy to tender love, from the spiritual to the cynical. There's no real narrative, rather a tableau of many elements with a roller coaster of emotions. Musically, Orff combines many different styles. We hear Stravinsky's influence, for example, in all the cross rhythms. We hear monks in a monastery and elements of Gregorian chant. Some of the songs pose huge challenges for the singers, especially for the soloists. For example, the tenor, who gets only one short song to depict the dying moments of a swan roasting on a spit, is expected to sing a top D. And finding a tenor who has a full voice top D isn't easy. Parts of the baritone songs are so high they're often sung in falsetto. The soprano soloist sings not only high, but also low, and is expected to hold notes longer than humanly possible. One of the things I love about Carmina is that it has so much variety. There's something for everyone. And it's clear everyone has responded, hence its popularity. It's been used countless times in popular culture and movies. It's been excerpted to sell everything from cars to aftershave. Today we have a wide range of associations for the piece. And why not add South Bend Symphony to your associations and come hear our performance April 18 at the Morris Performing Arts Center. For details of all our concerts, check out southbendsymphony.org. Thank you for listening to Aha with Alastair on WVPE.org.